Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning and happy Monday, everybody. We've got some great guests and conversations this morning and all this week. In just a minute, Newsweek's Jonathan Alter on the Wisconsin Democrats reportedly planning to come home to vote and what that means. And Republican senators like McConnell and McCain urging President Obama to use the military more aggressively in Libya. Also today, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She's becoming more outspoken on women's issues and the budget. A Libyan-American working for democracy in her country who happens to work here at WNYC. We will meet on the media producer, Sarah Abdurrahman, plus the New York Times executive editor today, the guy in charge, Bill Keller. We'll talk about the Times and about the world, and we'll continue our series on the national science test questions that American kids can't answer with none other than Bill Nye, the science guy. Yes, Bill Nye today. Newsweek columnist Jonathan Alter is here now. Also a contributor to Bloomberg News and The Daily Beast, analyst for MSNBC, and the author of The Promise, about President Obama's first year. On this day that we're told by The Wall Street Journal that the Wisconsin Senate Democrats will soon return to the state and finally take that fateful vote, they had to do it eventually, that would end most collective bargaining for public employees in the state, but they hope might also leave Governor Scott Walker a national punchline. At least that seems to be the Democrats' gamble. We will also talk about John McCain and Mitch McConnell asking President Obama to ratchet it up militarily in Libya. Hello, Jonathan Alter. Welcome back to WNYC.
How are you, Brian?
Good, thank you. This is only a journal story as far as I know. Do you know if the Wisconsin Democrats have decided to stop hiding out across state lines in return for that vote?
You know, I can't confirm independently the Wall Street Journal story. I did talk over the weekend to somebody in Chicago who had seen the Wisconsin legislators. So they're not exactly in the witness protection program. You know, there have been a lot of negotiations going on. The bottom line is they don't have the votes, but they do have the public because the polls have been very unfavorable for Governor Walker in Wisconsin and nationally. He just overplayed his hand. So we'll see how it plays out over time. But I think there's kind of a consensus among the public that there need to be major concessions on these contracts and pensions by the unions. But the idea of busting the unions by eliminating collective bargaining for everything except wages is just a kind of a non-starter at this point nationally and within Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think the Wall Street Journal's own poll with NBC News the other day found that 60% of Americans side with the unions on the right to retain collective bargaining in the public sector. Do you think that's a shock to Republican strategists? Is it even a shock to you?
You know, it is kind of surprising to me because unions have been in such decline in this country. The public employees unions in particular in the last couple of years, especially, I think there's been a genuine understanding that they got more than their private sector counterparts in a lot of cases, and that there were some real abuses with double dipping and, you know, running up the overtime so they had these huge retirement packages at age 55. And so the public had kind of lost faith in those unions, and yet there was some kind of vestigial understanding on the part of the American public that the unions are, at the end of the day, on the side of working people, and they were not the ones who took the economy into the crapper in the last 3 years. That was what used to be called management. You know, those are the other guys who did that, who took us to this place.
As one of my guests said last week, Wall Street crashed the economy and we're taking it out on school teachers.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. But it's one of the reasons it's being taken out on not just school teachers, but public employees in general, is that many Democrats, including Governor Cuomo, understand those contracts got got out of whack. And you know,
sure.
They are.
So does this mean that the American people actually can hold two thoughts in their heads at the same time? You know, that A, some public employee health and pension benefits have become excessive and unaffordable and should be rolled back, as the Wisconsin unions agreed to do, and as you say, Governor Cuomo wants. But that doesn't mean teachers and cops should lose their ability to even negotiate their working conditions?
That's exactly right. And it's actually sort of refreshing good news that there is a basic common sense to the American public, and that they can't. It's not necessarily two opposing ideas at the same time, but there's a complexity there that the public had to sort through. And, you know, it reminds me of something that President Clinton said to me once when I caught up with him on what had to be one of the most embarrassing days in the history of the American presidency. Was the day that the Paula Jones deposition ran all day on television, and the sitting president is talking about the most intimate details of his sex life, and he was at a function at NYU at the end of the day, and I caught up with him and I asked him how he was doing. And he told me a couple of things. He said, you know, first of all, he had been approached by somebody at the UN, a Latin American leader, earlier in the day, who had said, this is in Clinton's voice, he said, you know, you're lucky. In our country, when they stage a coup d'etat, they use real bullets, you know. So he felt like there was, you know, at least as bad as things were for him at that point, you know, at least we resolved things peacefully here. And the other thing he said is that if you give the American people enough information and enough time, quote, they always get it right. Now, I'm not so sure I would agree with Clinton that they always get it right, but mm-hmm. I think that he's on to something important that you're driving at here, Brian, which is that if the press can focus enough on the issues and provide enough public information, which is what happened in Wisconsin, the public can make these subtle distinctions, and they can hold two contrary ideas in their head at the same time.
Well, let's hope. Jonathan Alter from Newsweek. I was even wondering if you were present for a political turning point on this. Last Monday, you were on Morning Joe on MSNBC when Joe Scarborough, kind of the House conservative that he is, said this on national television.
I hate to say this, but the concept of telling people that they cannot come together to negotiate with a government, it just kind of seems un-American to me. And that's why I'm going to get killed. I'm no friend of the unions. Yeah. But does that not seem like, let me put it in a better way.
Mm-hmm.
Does it not seem like the most American thing to do to say, hey, let's assemble?
Yes,
like
but
freedom
the process
of assembly. And then we can negotiate with the powerful government.
Joe Scarborough, you were on the set at the time being interviewed, and you know, look, this was Joe Scarborough, not Rachel Maddow, and he called it un-American for Scott Walker to try and abolish collective bargaining.
Yeah, because what Walker was doing was he was using a budget crisis as an excuse to drive a highly ideological agenda. And I think that, you know, Scarborough objected to Barack Obama doing some of that in 2009. You know, you remember the Rahm Emanuel line, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joe and a number of other conservatives thought that it was just awful for Obama to use the stimulus to accomplish some of his political objectives. And he's intellectually honest enough to recognize that Walker is now doing the same thing on the other side. This is not about the budget crisis. This is about Walker's efforts to smash the unions. And if Walker were, you know, if he had run on smashing the unions, then I think you'd have more of a mandate to do this.
Before I get off this topic, do you think that now that the Democrats and Wisconsin's Senate are going to come back eventually, that the Republicans in the Senate are going to run away from this a little bit and they're ultimately not going to break the collective bargaining?
You know, I don't know Wisconsin politics well enough to know that. I know it's fairly polarized there. I mean, this is a place that had both Joe McCarthy and Robert La Follette, you know, in the old days. And so they traditionally, it only seems like a modern state. It's actually a pretty left state and a pretty right state. So I'm not sure that.
All right, so we'll see what happens.
Right wingers will do that.
You know what else I wonder? And you wrote a book on the FDR era, so maybe you have a historical insight into this. Where is the outcry from the private sector about themselves? We learned from the recent polls, as we've been discussing, that people support collective bargaining rights for public employee unions. But there is little outcry about strengthening private sector workers' own hands. Why, instead of insisting simply that public employees get health and pension benefits as pathetic as the rest of us, don't they take to the streets to demand better health and pension benefits for themselves?
Well, because the structure of the American economy has changed. I mean, when we had an industrial economy, we had large numbers of workers working in largely blue-collar occupations for big companies. Organized labor had an easier time, and it's just, you know, much harder when you have an economy that's based more on you know, small white-collar firms. They've been harder to organize, and also the plain fact is that corporate America over the last 30 years has engaged in a very sophisticated campaign using very creative law firms, if that's not a contradiction in terms, to undercut union organizing, and they've got a lot of favorable court decisions. And they've greatly strengthened what they first got in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act, which you know, which weakened unions. And you could argue that things have been on a slow and then recently more rapid decline for unions ever since. So it's not just a matter of, you know, which side Americans are on, and that's its own separate question, because a lot of Americans, you know, want to be rich and they don't identify with labor as much as they used to. But it's also structural in the laws that apply to unions and in the way our economy is organized.
Fair enough. I want to get to one other issue. Jonathan Alter from Newsweek, and author of The Promise, book about President Obama's administration, with me on WNYC. Some Republicans and conservatives are calling for the president to show more military aggressiveness in Libya. Here is John McCain on TV yesterday calling for a no-fly zone.
Their air assets are not large. Their air defenses are somewhat antiquated. And this would send a signal to Gaddafi that the president is serious when he says we need for Gaddafi to go. And also it would be encouraging to the resistance, who are certainly outgunned from the air.
So that was John McCain on ABC this week. But White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley went on Meet the Press, and as popular as this idea of a no-fly zone to enforce, you know, against Gaddafi shooting at his own people on the ground, as popular as that may seem, Bill Daley, the White House Chief of Staff, said this.
Lots of people throw around phrases of no-fly zone, and they talk about it as though it's just a game on a video game or something. And some people who throw that line out have no idea what they're talking about.
So, Jonathan Alter, why is the White House resisting this?
I'd say largely because Defense Secretary Robert Gates thinks it's a bad idea right now, and he has a tremendous amount of influence within this administration. And also, you know, when John McCain talks about sending a signal to Gaddafi, I'm not sure what he means. Gaddafi's crazy. It's that there's no incoming signal reception there. You know, it's not like if we do something that he somehow is going to start acting in a rational way. He's a lunatic.
And what does a no-fly zone accomplish? There isn't that much bombing from the air, is there? Most of the stuff is taking place on the ground. So is it more symbolic?
Well, Gates's point is it's not symbolic, because in order to set up a no-fly zone, the first thing you have to do is take out the anti-aircraft that's on the ground. That means going to war. That means bombing those anti-aircraft installations so that they cannot endanger American aircraft that are enforcing the no-fly zone. So it is, you are crossing a line to military action when you go to a no-fly zone. But as we learned with the no-fly zone in Iraq under Clinton in the 90s, it doesn't necessarily mean that the regime is going to cry uncle just because you put up a no-fly zone. So it's one of those things that's become kind of a nice buzzword. As Bill Daley points out, most people don't really know much of what it entails, and it's not a solution for this lunatic.
Then there was Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, on Face the Nation. John Kerry, the Democrat, was there too, and listen to what McConnell said.
The other option that John Kerry alluded to in passing that I think we used frequently during the Cold War period is simply aiding and arming the insurgents.
Aiding and arming the insurgents. That was so successful when we did it in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, that's that can be a difficult road. But I think there are, you know, bigger questions about what kind of foreign policy Barack Obama really believes in here. And, you know, my sense is that what we're really seeing here is the multilateralist, to use a fancy term, coming out. He does not want the United States to take direct military action without it being having true international involvement, not just a kind of a coalition of the willing that Bush used to talk about that's not real, but mm-hmm. something where our allies, including Turkey, you know, genuinely join us in addressing this problem. And I think that makes sense, because if you don't do that, if it just becomes the United States and one or two other countries staging military action, you give the Arabs a lot of recruitment opportunities, because then it seems like
you give the radicals a lot of recruitment opportunities.
Yes, but Arab leaders across the region could rally. You know, the dictators could rally their people against yet more of what they would consider to be, you know, neo-colonial intervention.
One other thing, we have a minute left. Newsweek, your publication, is reinventing itself, I think, as of this week, with your fancy new editor, Tina Brown, of Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, and Daily Beast fame. Can you remake the sinking form of the weekly news magazine with Tina Brown?
Well, if anybody can do it, Tina can. She has just such tremendous energy, tremendous news sense of what people are interested in. And I think that we've got a, you know, better than a fighting chance. So I'm actually very excited about what she's starting to do.
All right. Well, I'm rooting for you. So Jonathan Thanks. Alter, correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, also contributes to Bloomberg News, analyst for MSNBC and NBC News. And his book out in paperback is The Promise, President Obama, Year One, published by Simon & Schuster, with updated material to reflect after year one. Jonathan, as always, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand next. Stay with us.